Our New Testament lesson this morning is from the book of Acts, chapter 2, verses 42 through 47. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread, and to the prayers. Awe came upon everyone because many wonders and signs were being done by the apostles. All who believed were together and had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all as any had need. Day by day, as they spent much time together in the temple, they broke bread at home and ate their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having goodwill of all the people. And day by day, the Lord added to their number those who were being saved.
Do you remember the story in the third chapter of John when Nicodemus comes to visit Jesus at night? It's a most fascinating conversation. It's notable, I think, for Jesus describing how seeing the kingdom of God requires being born from above. We laugh with Nicodemus asking how one could be born a second time. Could one enter into his mother's womb, he asks. But even though Jesus likens spiritual birth to something we can understand like the wind, we still sympathize with Nicodemus. Spiritual birth is not an easy thing to understand. But there's something else that's funny about that story with Nicodemus. Nicodemus comes to Jesus, but doesn't even seem to have a question formulated to ask. And it's not that Nicodemus wouldn't have been spending time thinking about, what am I going to ask? Think about it. If you knew you were going to have a chance to see Jesus, would you plan out a question maybe to ask? At least you'd spend some time thinking about it. What you would actually do when you got there might be different, but I'm sure you would spend some time thinking about what you would want to say or what you would want to ask. For Nicodemus to come to Jesus was a risky thing. He was a Pharisee, and the Pharisees had a conflicted relationship with Jesus. The Pharisees were the ones that said, it's all about the law. And Jesus kept saying to the Pharisees, you don't get what the law is about. But beyond that, Nicodemus was a member of the Sanhedrin, the high Jewish council. He was a leader of all Jews. And so someone in that kind of position isn't supposed to, number one, have questions for another rabbi. Number two, be seen in the presence of such a scandalous person like Jesus. So it's best to come at night when others won't see. But despite the fact that Nicodemus gets there and doesn't know anything else to say to Jesus except, you seem like a really godly man. Jesus knows why Nicodemus is there. Jesus is suggesting to Nicodemus, you're on the verge of a spiritual awakening. Jesus sees things around him, around Nicodemus, that Nicodemus is seeing but doesn't yet understand. The answers that Nicodemus has been given by his tradition, his schooling, his colleagues, don't add up. Nicodemus can see the hypocrisy and fear of the political and religious establishment. He can see that Jesus is offering something different. He looks at Jesus and sees that Jesus gets the law. He really gets it. It's coming to life in what he says, and somehow Jesus is still pointing toward something completely beyond the law. And what could be more captivating to a Pharisee than the notion that there's something even beyond, even better, bigger than the law? What is it? Nicodemus wonders. Jesus says, Nicodemus, you're about to be born a second time. I love that story in Scripture. Looking back on my own life, I can remember my second birth. I can't remember my first. We periodically quiz Goldie on whether she remembers being born. She's seen some pictures, you know, but she doesn't remember it, which is probably good because it was like 33 hours, so not something you want to remember. But I remember my own second birth, and it wasn't a single event. It happened in stages. I'd been in spiritual gestation for years. And my spiritual birth coincided with the awakening of my political consciousness. Now, politics is an ugly business. And no preacher raises politics without fear and trembling, because politics always raises red flags for so many in our culture, let alone in our congregations. Why is that? Is it because we're heartbroken over what divides us? Is it because we're tired of religion being used to put social pressure on us to conform to something we don't actually believe? Is it because we resist the idea that there's one right or moral or Christian way to think about political dilemmas? Are we conflicted about the things we believe that don't fit too well with our religious tradition? When I speak of my own political awakening, I'm speaking about my awakening to the powers at work in the world. I grew up learning about my parents' political awakening during the Vietnam War and the struggle in our nation for civil rights. I grew up watching the world's two superpowers bankrupt each other in a never-ending arms race. I grew up learning that the United States and Soviet Union were fighting each other all over the world, even though our troops weren't really facing each other on the battlefield on almost every continent. We were sending arms and advisors, and we were at war with each other. Indeed, one can make a most convincing case that the most intractable conflicts we're fighting today, and that are incidentally costing us trillions of dollars, have their roots in the unresolved conflicts of the Cold War period. I was 10 years old in 1980, wondering aloud with my parents, why are people putting yellow ribbons on their cars, like tying them around the car antenna or the rear view mirror or the side mirror? Why would Iranians take Americans hostage? My 10-year-old mind was trying to wrap its head around. In 1981, I was asking, why are we still building so many nuclear weapons? In 1982, I watched on television the aftermath of the bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut. Several hundred dead. Why do we have Marine barracks there? I started watching the morning and the evening news. In 1983, I was 13 years old when we learned that the CIA had been mining harbors in Nicaragua. Why would we do that? I was asking. Increasingly, it seemed that the answers provided revolved around communism. And communism, as everyone knew, was anti-democratic and anti-American. It was like cancer. It was a mortal threat to freedom and democracy. Yes, a few good cells would have to be wiped out too if one hoped to beat it. But watching the news, going to Sunday school, reading the Bible, listening to sermons, asking these hard questions, and not accepting pat answers made things a bit more complicated for me. But some patterns emerged. and my heart began to awaken. First, with a sense of my own spiritual call or purpose, and also with an understanding of spiritual power itself. So when I speak about my own political awakening, I'm not talking about proclaiming my loyalty to the Democratic Party or all of a sudden getting involved in politics. It was an awakening to the way power works in our world, for good and for ill. When I started college as a peace studies major at Manchester, I was fortunate to have a number of opportunities to travel to Latin America. Now, I'd already learned a fair amount about the history of that region. I'd learned that the common person in Latin America wasn't concerned with the great global conflict between East and West, between capitalism and communism. Their biggest problems had to do with poverty, indentured servitude, extreme political repression, and a lack of self-determination. Their populations were grossly divided by class. The political elites with the wealth and the power, that is, if they kept on good terms with Washington. The peasants were destitute, increasingly desperate for change and agitating for revolution. The small middle class generally owed its meager wealth to the elites, but were increasingly troubled by the repression of the peasants and looked for ways to reform their systems while avoiding revolution. But here in the U.S., the mainstream media were describing revolutionaries as Marxists, socialists, and terrorists. The counter-revolutionaries and death squads were called freedom fighters. American corporations like Dole and United Fruit, who kept us supplied with cheap Central American bananas and sugar and coffee, were hailed as champions of democracy. And those, even in the U.S., who exposed their complicity in government repression of agricultural workers were effectively denounced as socialists. Today, my sermon asks, how do we make peace with socialists? But maybe our first challenge is to ask why we need to. Are there still socialists? We've been told socialists lost the Cold War. We're under the impression that Latin America no longer has repressive regimes or revolutionary movements. Is the problem solved? No. The problems aren't solved. And even if you're not convinced that the fundamental patterns which shaped the conflicts of the Cold War era persist today, there's no denying that our public is as divided as ever over how to deal with what all of us agree are challenges to our national interest. To all of us, challenges like terrorism, like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, challenges like economic volatility, largely driven by access to important resources like energy and water and land. Economic opportunity in our own nation, the wealthiest nation in the world, the middle class is shrinking, the wealth gap is growing, and too many full-time workers can't make ends meet while they're working full-time. Like it or not, a self-proclaimed democratic socialist almost won his party's nomination to this presidential election. So there's something out there about socialism that still resonates for many people. And if you're a Christian, at least I'd say if you're a good Christian, there should be something that resonates. Because at the heart of socialism is a vision that we can live more closely to our ideals than we are. The lesson from Acts tells the story about the early Christian church. This is the group of people that knew Jesus. The people that had heard him preach and teach, had seen his miracles, and were there. The story actually takes place, it's set just after the Pentecost, when 3,000 some odd people from all over the world at that time, that region of the world, came together, people who spoke different languages, were listening to Peter preach. And as he lays out his vision of Christ's call, they're overwhelmed. The power of the Spirit breathes in such a tangible way to that group that 3,000 of them decide, this is it. This is what we want to give our whole lives to. And so they decide to share all of their possessions, as Scott read. Essentially, they gave as they had ability and took as any had need. Though that whole notion would later be ascribed to socialists, it actually started biblically. That idea that the strong bear helped to bear up the infirmities of the weak. Now, don't misunderstand me. I understand we're allergic to socialism in this country, and my aim here is not to convince anyone to become a socialist. But I do think that we need to make peace with socialism, or at least make peace with socialists, because there's enough that resonates with the biblical vision and call of Christ that we need to take it seriously. And there are some things that we can do that make a difference. Probably the most famous socialist in the world is Karl Marx. When Karl Marx was writing, was basically like the 1840s to 1870s or so. So if you think about what was going on in the world during our Civil War, the years just leading up to it and just following our Civil War. We were in the middle of the Industrial Revolution. Most people in the world still earned their living tending crops, but it was about to change. It was in the process of changing because science, technology, and capital made it possible to build factories, mass production, assembly lines, required human assistance. And so people became a part of the machine. And a new class emerged. In addition to poor farmers, the world was beginning to see children working in factories for little or no wages. When good people ask the hard questions, how have we become like this? Religion of the day offered conflicting answers, but too often it was suggested that God created people with different abilities, and the people with less ability were destined to work on the factory floor. Too often there were religions that said, like places where there are caste systems, religions said certain people were simply destined, ordained by God toward this kind of life. Karl Marx was one of a growing number of intellectuals who criticized philosophers, one of Marx's most important quotes. The philosophers of the world have only interpreted the world in different ways. The point is to change it. Marx was motivated and emboldened by the scientific revolution to find a more scientific way to understand what has created the world that we live in. He was convinced that rather than simply lifting up moral ideals and saying we need to make a world like this, that we could actually examine the mechanisms, what he called the modes of production, or essentially who's in charge of the things that generate wealth and how does it shape everything else about our culture. Now, we don't have time today to get into all the criticism of dialectical materialism and all the notions of, I know some people who studied political economics and things would be more conversant than I even on being able to describe the pros and cons of a Marxist critique on our culture. But I think what we, at least as Christians who care about the plight of the poor, can agree is that, like Marx, it behooves us to ask, what is our culture doing for the least of these? That's a question that Jesus asked. That was our lesson last week. Too often, religion, especially in the powerful nations of the world, has lent its voice toward a notion of ideological purity, suggesting that the most important thing people of faith can do is believe the right thing, say the right thing. It was our pietous forebearers who said, what we do matters more than what we say. And it was the prophet Ezekiel who reminded people who wanted to turn the story of Sodom and Gomorrah into a lesson about how to be morally righteous and pure. Ezekiel said, no, you've missed the point. He says in chapter 16, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and needy. They were haughty and did abominable things before me. Therefore, I removed them when I saw it. Friends, I know none of us is accustomed to talking politics or economics in church. We've grown used to the idea that what we can do something about in our world is making ourselves better people. And I think it's true that we really don't accomplish societal change without individuals being transformed, being born again. But at the same time, individuals being born again doesn't end slavery. It doesn't bring civil rights. It takes people who've been born again changing the rules by which we live together. We have some things to learn from socialists, especially those who are the more scientific sort, who actually sit down and study the mechanisms by which cultures transform, by which classes are divided and subjugated. I've spent a good amount of time in Guatemala, and one of the most alarming things that I've seen there is the rampant growth of a breed of Pentecostalism, which tells people it's okay to suffer because you're just suffering now. In the next life, you'll be rewarded. You'll be rewarded for your suffering. And it's no coincidence that the single person who's the most responsible for the rise of Pentecostalism in Guatemala is the former military dictator, himself a born-again Christian, Rios Montt. He's evaded trial a number of times for war crimes. He led a 30-year civil war with the support of the United States and blessed the movement of American missionaries in Guatemala because it did such a good job of keeping poor people from agitating for change. Friends, I don't think it's the job of Christians to get into the right economic or political ideology, to identify with the right team. But I do think it's absolutely necessary for us to ask the hard questions and not accept pat answers, and to lift above all else the work of Jesus, who understood the spiritual awakening in his own life as a rebirth and transformation for the world. He said, it's being fulfilled right now. The hungry are being fed. The naked are being clothed. Sight is coming to the blind. The sick are being healed. We're freeing people from prison. We're lifting people out of oppression. Would you like to continue this work? Yes. Let us all affirm the sacred work of liberating God's people and living according to the reality that we believe and proclaim even in the Lord's Prayer, that God's kingdom come on this earth as it is in heaven.